So apparently someone announced a designer handbag made of T-Rex collagen. So apparently this came out on April 2nd of this year. So the article makes clear it's not an April Fool's joke, but someone actually is saying they got a purse made out of dinosaur. That's, you know, people are wondering if it comes in Velociraptor.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams.
And I'm Ryan Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
So Doug is out on that proverbial assignment. So we've got Ryan joining us, and you know what that means. We're going to go through the latest creation magazine. So welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
So, you know, you've actually become quite the podcast guy. You're kind of becoming an expert at this. So I know you and a good friend of yours from high school, you've started a channel on called the Oil Boys, and it's on fantasy football, and you're making quite a headway in TikTok. Now, I know you've got a little bit of work to do on YouTube. I think you're approaching the magical number of 30 subscribers. You know, right now, Real Science Radio, Ryan, we're at over 140,000 subscribers on our channel. So for those listening on the radio at KLTT in Denver, be sure to check out our YouTube channel, and, you know, it helps to subscribe, to like our videos, to leave comments, and to help the channel grow. And, you know, hopefully that'll happen to your channel soon, Ryan, on YouTube.
Yeah, hopefully we can replicate the Real Science Radio success.
All right, so what do we got in store today?
We've got Volume 48, Number 3, and this one's really packed. There's Mother of Pearl Concrete, Shark Hypnotism, Antibiotic Resistance that Predates Antibiotics, Energy Saving Penguins, Dinosaur Fashion, The Platypus Back in the News, Brown Cow Using Tools, and a Chinese Skull That's Out of Sync with Evolution.
So other than engineering, microbiology, shark behavior, which I think that'll be really interesting. You and I had a fun show on shark behavior in the past. There's also, you know, we've got animal navigation, dinosaur soft tissue. You mentioned dinosaur fashion. That'll be interesting. Fashion, what do we mean by that? Weird mammals, fossil birds, and tool use by a brown cow. So not much going on in this issue, Ryan.
Yeah, slow issue, slow news week for creation.
So that's what I, you know, really like about Creation Magazine. We've been doing these shows for many years now. Bob and I started doing them way back when we started Real Science Radio, and you've since taken over doing those. We try to do them quarterly. It reminds us that creation science is not just one narrow topic. It touches on everything from biology, geology, astronomy, medicine, engineering, history, and worldview, because the creator made all of it.
And it's the pattern just always shows up, which is so cool. The more careful we look at nature, we see design, engineering, purpose. And the more we look, the more evolutionary stories have to change and things covered up, and just the weaker their position becomes.
Yeah, that's right. So let's go ahead and get right into it, Ryan. So first up is an article on advanced concrete inspired by Mother of Pearl, or as I like to call it, engineers once again copying God's homework.
Well, let's hope they at least cited the author.
Well, you'll have to wait to see if they actually cite the original author, but, you know. Anyways, Ryan, what's this one all about?
Right, so it's the Mother of Pearl, which is also called nacre, and it's famous for being strong and tough, even though its raw ingredients aren't really impressive themselves. It's made from brittle aragonite, which is a form of calcium carbonate, plus soft protein. So the secret really isn't the ingredients, it's how they're arranged. And it kind of, the article talks about how the tiny materials are stacked in layers and then joined by these protein sheets that are kind of soft, so these layers let the tiles move slightly under stress, which absorbs energy and helps it not to crack, and or if it does crack, the cracks don't spread as much. So engineers thought this was really cool and useful, since, you know, concrete, you know, cracks all the time. So they've since copied this and made a tougher cement with this same idea, with this tile hardened cement sheets cut into hexagon shapes. and layered with a soft polymer, which kind of mimics the protein. And the result was 17 times tougher than hardened concrete paste alone.
Wow. So that's a classic design story. The secular world calls it biomimicry, but another way to say that is that engineers are studying God's design and trying to imitate it. They do that all the time, and it's a smart thing to do. And it's funny, Ryan, if humans create a layered composite material, everyone says, great engineering. But when the same kind of brilliant material design appears in nature, we're told it only looks designed. So this is another great example of the difference between material and structure. You can have ordinary materials, but when they're intelligently arranged, you get extraordinary performance. That principle shows up all over the place in biology, everything. So bone, shell, feathers, you know, like we've talked about spider silk before and how impressive that is. And so many other materials that are not just chemicals. They actually have a function. And they're organized systems, Ryan.
Yeah, that's why biomimicry is such a powerful creation argument. Like, imagine if you told the engineers on this who figured this out, it's like, oh, hey, we're going to take away all the credit from you and just say it happened. They'd be like, well, hold on, what gives? So these guys, and they just copied the original design, and the natural world is just beautiful. It's also technically sophisticated. Yeah, evolution has to say this thing just arose naturally, but scientists with all their nifty tools and stuff are still trying to figure all this out, which is just really cool to see.
Yeah, and it takes intelligence to copy it. And, you know, maybe, Ryan, it took intelligence to create it in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Biomimicry really is just a scientific art of copying what God's already done.
Yeah, yeah. He just has a better, the best possible blueprint. And, Ryan, I wanted to mention, you know, you work at Micron as a firmware engineer. And one of the things you do, because I worked with you for a little bit there at Micron before I retired, but you work on what's called the Flash Translation Layer, FTL. And this actually reminded me a little bit of this whole process, and it's what it's called flash wear leveling that you're doing there. And I'm not saying Micron copied the mother of pearl here, but the design principle seems similar to me. So you don't let stress concentrate in one weak spot. You spread the load, manage the structure, and the whole system lasts longer. A lot of people don't know this about NAND memory. Those, you know, those laptops you buy at Best Buy, they've actually got a little bit of a ticking clock on those things that, you know, we brag about, oh, these got SSDs in them, where you're the engineer behind the system that's helping those SSDs last longer.
It's a decent comparison because, like you kind of said, the NAND is also layered, even though it's a completely different purpose. But we do have to keep an eye on how much certain areas are hit and make sure that's spread evenly across the whole device, or else if you let one area get hit rapidly, that area is going to be under a lot of stress, sort of like these mother of pearl concrete things. And that area gets under too much stress, that area is going to go bad. And all of a sudden you're going to lose all of that space where you can store stuff. So it is really important to spread things out and even out the stress, sort of like is happening here with the mother of pearl.
Yeah. And I know in your world that with those NAND devices and SSD drives, when those things start losing memory and you're kind of using a lot of memory, your computer really starts to slow down. So, so laptops aren't lasting as long. And one of the big reasons is because the SSDs, you know, over time, they wear out.
So it's really important, Ryan, if you have one, to make sure you don't use more than like 70% of the available storage, or else it is going to go bad a lot quicker because you just don't have as much room to store stuff and don't have as much room to even out the load across it.
Yeah. So I don't think the Best Buy salespeople are telling their customers that, are they?
I don't think so. So they like the idea they can come back in 2 years, 3 years and get a new one.
Yeah, that's true. So when your work is done wear leveling, it's not exactly copying oysters, but it is obeying a design principle that God had already built into the world. So mm-hmm. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, Ryan, I wanted to get into this next one about the sharks playing possum. And so what is this one all about?
Yeah, so this one's pretty fascinating. So sharks can be put into a trance, basically, called tonic immobility. So depending on the species, it can happen by rubbing electrosensory regions around the snout, or which is basically like tickling them almost. Or you can flip them over and apply pressure to the tail fin. So the question the article was talking about was, what's this for? So suggestions include playing dead to avoid predators like playing possum, or it can aid in mating. It can cool down if there's sensory overload. But recently, researchers are kind of thinking all those aren't it, and they sort of have thrown those out, for lack of a better word. And now they're saying that it's a vestigial structure that's just left over from past evolution and has no purpose now.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, they love that word vestigial, but, you know, really, Ryan, that word's backfired on them big time. So it's caused them all kinds of embarrassment over the years. We don't know what it does. It's not the same thing as it does nothing. And so how many times have we discovered in biology and just the human design how many things that were so-called vestigial have been shown to actually have a purpose? So, Ryan, one of the things when I saw this article, it reminded me of a show you and I did in Creation Magazines, I think a couple years ago, and it was about shark attack prevention. So we had a clip of me fighting off Jaws. So here, let's play that clip really quick. It's in the back of my mind. Is there some great white out there looking to chow down on old Fred Williams? I don't know, because it's a mystery. What's in the water? I mean, it could be any kind. It could be a tiger shark. I mean, for me, I'm imagining a great white, you know?
Yeah. Jaws mode.
Oh, that's a good one. If only you would have known to do the tickle thing and put it in the trance.
Yeah, instead of kicking with my feet at it, if I just go, here's a little sharky. Tickle, tickle.
Coochie coo.
Yeah. And so, Ryan, the article makes exactly the point that a complex and widespread mechanism has all the hallmarks of purposeful design. Now, the article also says that if it were useless, you'd expect natural selection to eliminate it over time. Now, natural selection is something that a creationist actually came up with. But it's interesting that CMI, Creation Ministries International, kind of leans a little bit more on natural selection than ICR, the Institute of Creation Research. And they talk more about continuous environmental tracking. It's a real interesting debate that's going on. We at Real Science Radio tend to lean more towards a lot of the traits that we have so much power and ingenuity designed into the genome that it knows how to do certain things at the right time. And so that's part of what is continuous environmental tracking, that there's cues from the environment that can make certain proteins be built or whatever to make the animal react to certain ways to nature. And so maybe it's a combination of the two, but the bottom line is, Ryan, there's no way that this wasn't purposefully designed.
Yeah, I agree. And even if the answer is we don't know yet what it does, it's a better answer than just saying, oh, we don't know what it does, so it can't possibly do anything. It has to be left over. It's like, that's kind of a lazy answer. You're not going to look any further to see what it might be, because there's been so many things throughout time that they've been marked, oh, this is worthless leftover. And it's like, oh, no, this actually does have a use. The, you know, appendix is a big example of that.
Yeah, tonsils and so many others. So it's a fascinating mechanism. Yeah, right now, maybe it has an unknown purpose other than maybe me being able to hypnotize it, you know, kind of let it kind of go to sleep while it's trying to attack me. But let's not rush to this whole evolutionary leftover like these secular scientists do. So, okay, Ryan, before we get too far into the show, we have to do our interesting fact of the week. And this interesting fact segment is sponsored by Joe in South Carolina. We want to thank him for sponsoring this segment. And you can go to store.rsr.org and click on the donate. And then on that page, you'll find a way to sponsor one of our shows or just donate to RSR. We don't have some big mega church behind us, so in order to stay on the air, we need your help. And that reminds me, we've got new materials in our store, all kinds of new materials, from Ellen McHenry to, of course, the 9th edition of Walt Brown's In the Beginning. And Real Science Radio has just released the list of not-so-old things. And also, we recently, about a month ago, we released Jesus Light and Design. I know, Ryan, you had a chance to review Jesus Light and Design. I appreciate you being one of the editors on that book before it got released.
Yeah, I did read that one. I thought it was really good. Super, a lot of interesting stuff in there that I didn't know before. I haven't gotten to the not so old things yet, but that's next up on my list.
Yeah, we're going to get you a copy here real soon. So, and guys, if you can go to store.rsr.org, and that helps us also if you buy our products. And if you do buy one of the books, whether it be the Walt Brown book or one of our books, go to Amazon and leave a review. And even if you want to buy it on Amazon, that's fine with us, because reviews on Amazon really help push this material to other audiences, to wider audiences. It's huge to the Amazon algorithm that they see reviews on books. So, okay, Ryan, are you ready for the interesting fact of the week?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. How many flowers do bees have to visit to make 1 liter or 2 U.S. pints of honey?
Playtime.
Wow. I have
how
no
many flowers?
No idea. Do I even get like a multiple choice or something, or do I just got to pull out the number off the top of my head?
Well, if you get, say, within, say 20, I'll give it to you.
20? Okay.
Okay, no, maybe 100.
Right, so it's not like 6.
How many flowers do they have to visit to make 1 liter of honey?
Let's say 1 liter. That's kind of a lot. But then again, maybe it isn't a ton. It's kind of impressive either way. If they like don't have to go to that many and can produce a whole bunch. Or if they can go to that many to get there, it's kind of impressive. Let's say 872.
Okay, I'll give you one more guess and you can be within 100,000.
Oh boy. Okay, how about 612,486?
Okay, it's actually 4 million flowers.
Oh my gosh, that's
so
crazy.
You know, the next time someone puts honey in their tea, they should, you know, pause and thank God for, you know, all the work that goes into making this honey, and to all those hardworking little pollinators on Earth.
That's
so
incredible.
I mentioned that as an interesting fact because I don't think we'll get to it, but Jerry Bergman has a really cool article in this Creation magazine on bees. And so if you don't have the magazine, you should go get it. You can go to creation.com, order their magazine. It's our favorite of all, the pretty much just a basic magazine that anybody can read. It's very well done. They've always done a great job with it. So go to creation.com. And if you buy a subscription to their Creation magazine, you can read it online like you and I are doing right now. So, all right, Ryan. So what's up? What's next in store from Creation magazine?
So next up, I thought this was a pretty interesting one. It's antibiotic resistance before antibiotics. So essentially what it is the article talks about how scientists found antibiotic resistance in microbes from the Scarisoara ice cave in Romania. So the Psychobacter strain is isolated to what they say is thousands of years old, yet it shows resistance to modern antibiotics and carried over 100 antibiotic resistance genes. So the question with this is, how did it get antibiotic resistance if it existed long before antibiotics? Because that's what evolutionists always say, is some bacteria gains antibiotic resistance after it's exposed to antibiotics long enough. They say it's an example of evolution that, this thing evolved microbiotic resistance, but this thing is already resistant beforehand. So it must have been coded in before. And what's interesting is this thing was also not just resistant to one, but it was resistant to all 10 of the antibiotics tested. So some were used for tuberculosis and urinary tract infections. So yeah, this isn't a case where they were exposed to them and then became resistant. They just already were.
Yeah. So this one destroys one of their many talking points that they try to throw at us. So it's been one of their favorite examples. It's now been totally refuted. You know, they would say, hey, look, evolution is happening right in front of us. Totally not true. So again, resistance comes from pre-existing genes. Sometimes it comes from gene transfer, Ryan. There's so many different ways that this can happen. Sometimes it comes from losing function. You know, we are part of a broken creation. You know, like breaking a transport system so the antibiotic no longer gets into the cell. But none of that ever proved that bacteria turned into biologists. I mean, what they're trying to claim, essentially. It doesn't show anything towards molecules to man evolution at all.
Mm-hmm. Kind of reminds me of that famous nylon eating bacteria story that they love to bring up. And they often present it as after nylon was invented, bacteria magically evolved a brand new enzyme out of nowhere to digest it. But the story has been pretty soundly refuted, just like now this one with the antibiotics is too.
Yeah. And, you know, so that's a really good one. I'm glad you brought that up, Ryan, because we've done a show on that in the past, at least a show or two. And I seem to recall that Dr. John Sanford and our friend Sal Cordova, I'm pretty sure they dealt with this head on with the scientific article. And if we're wrong about that, just leave comments in the video or send us an email. It's probably better to leave comments in the video. Because again, comments on the YouTube video that you're watching, or if you're listening on KLTT in Denver, go to the YouTube and leave a comment. That also helps spread the video to other people to see it. They may be watching some other science channel. Maybe they're watching something on NASA, and then they see our little thing pop up because we've got a lot of comments on our video. Then it helps spread our Real Science Radio across the YouTube universe. So anyways, I know that this whole nylon-eating bacteria had long been disproven against John Sanford and Sal Cordova have an article on it. I'll try to find that, and we will link to it. So evolutionists have always been overselling the nylon thing. In fact, it's, again, totally been refuted, Brian. And this article in Creation Magazine is just another example of how these stories that they try to tell, they don't hold weight. They eventually just crumble to the ground. Okay, so next one, Ryan, I thought was really interesting is penguins choose longer routes to save energy. And, you know, this one might finally explain why my wife Sandy's directions always seem to take a longer route, as you've probably learned over the years. So, well, it turns out, Ryan, that your mom may not have been wrong. She may have been using this penguin navigation.
Maybe it was the whole time. Maybe it was truly an energy saving route this whole time.
Yeah,
we in the hundreds of examples of times.
I got to tell the audience this story. So we were at Elitch's years ago, and I think you're maybe 4 or 5 years old. And your mom and I were discussing which way to go. And, you know, I'm like, no, we got to go this way. And you look up.
I already know where this is going. I've already heard this one.
And you go, hey, Mom, why don't you let Dad do all the thinking and you do all the wondering? She hates when I tell that story. But anyway. But, you know, maybe, maybe she was onto something. So the article says that some modern GPS apps let you choose energy-saving routes, which are not always the shortest route. So apparently, these Magellanic penguins were doing this long before smartphones. So researchers tracked 27 of these penguins returning to their colony in Argentina using GPS loggers. And instead of swimming in a straight line home, the penguins basically hitch a ride on ocean currents and tides. So they drift away from the shortest path. But by using the currents, they save energy overall. As they get closer to home, they hunt less and focus more on navigation. And they can travel up to 75 kilometers on a single trip and still arrive within about 300 meters of their starting point, even on a dark night. I mean, how can this possibly have evolved, Ryan? There's just no way.
Yeah, it's incredible. And the article kind of talks about how they do it, too, that they have some sort of internal compass navigation, or they're just detecting the flow of water against their bodies, or they'd use some smell. There's a whole bunch of different ideas of how they do it, but it is just incredible. And how could that be something that evolved over time? How could that be slow, tiny mutation processes that now this penguin can nose to take a longer route back home because it'll save energy? It's just something that you can't see these tiny processes ever leading to.
Yeah, exactly. It reminds me of the golden plover. You know, when I've done my talk on information theory, the golden plover is always a good one because it flies from Alaska to Hawaii, and there's no way it can make it there if it flew just straight because it would use up all its energy. So how do they solve that problem? What information did God put into their brains? They fly in a V formation, which is really cool. So many examples like this that have to be pre-programmed information that just really puts another huge nail into the coffin of evolution.
And you even talked about how they have to travel 75 kilometers sometimes on a single trip. And the article goes into how they wind up super close to home at the end of this trip too. They're never like way far off. So just the innate GPS that's built into some animals' brains or instincts is incredible itself.
So they actually get close to their target. So I guess they might, maybe your mom wasn't onto something taking the longer route.
Yeah.
He's got close to her.
Maybe we're going to cut her some slack next time.
So, all right, Ryan, that one's super cool. The next one is, this is kind of funny, dinosaur designer fashion. Now, what do we mean by fashion with dinosaur soft tissue?
Yeah, so apparently someone announced a designer handbag made of T-Rex collagen. So apparently this came out on April 2nd of this year. So the article makes clear it's not an April Fool's joke, but someone actually is saying that they got a purse made out of dinosaur. That's, you know, people are wondering if it comes in Velociraptor. So,
yeah.
But apparently they use actual, some real dinosaur collagen. They did a whole bunch of stuff in a lab to actually make it on the large enough scale. So the article ends by pointing out that it's not truly real dinosaur collagen, but it is interesting what it started with. It's a big deal because these dinosaurs are supposed to be 60, 70 millions of years old, yet we've still got enough, we still find enough stuff to be able to say, oh, hey, we're making this handbag out of dinosaur collagen, which that couldn't possibly have survived for that long.
Yeah, and so that's been the paleontological find of the century, you know, the soft tissue, collagen, all this stuff in dinosaur bones that are supposed to be millions of years old. And if you're just now hearing about this, because again, this is huge. We talk about it a lot on Real Science Radio. You can find out more about it by going to rsr.org/dino. And we've actually got a list there of scientific articles whenever they discover more soft tissue, collagen, osteocytes, all these things that just make it no way that the bones are millions of years old. And these scientific articles, sorry, they're not from National Enquirer or from, you know, just from creation organizations. We're talking Harvard, Stanford, all of the major colleges that have been on board with this for quite a long time now. This isn't contamination. It's actual original biological material. These bones are not fully fossilized. Dinosaurs are not millions of years old, and that's another icon of evolution that has really come crashing down, you know, over the last 20 years. And we're trying to get more people to know about it, Ryan, because it's amazing. You talk to people that are just not really tuned in, and that's probably 80% of the population, it seems, and they're surprised to hear it. They're surprised. Oh, they don't believe you when you tell them it. Say, I remember your sister Abigail at college. She mentioned it to this tutor that was helping her with, I think, some science class. She got in a debate with him, and he's like, oh, there's no way. You know, this isn't possible. So she sent him that list of all these scientific articles from Harvard and Stanford and other places. And really, he had no comeback for it. He was just, it pretty much, a lot of times they meet it with silence, and then they just change the subject. But it's a great, great discovery. So it's kind of humorous, this whole purse, you know. Maybe creation, yeah. Say, maybe we'll get that into our RSR store at some point for lady listeners, a purse made from collagen, from the T-Rex collagen, even though it's really not made from collagen, but there'll be some collagen in it. So, hey, you know.
Yeah, that'd be a nice little victory bag to have.
That's right, a victory bag. I like it. So, okay, Ryan, the next one is the gloriously weird platypus. This one was super interesting, too. You know, the platypus has always been a really interesting creature. God's got a really creative mind, and the platypus really shows that.
Yeah, it's just such a strange thing. And the more we learn about it, the more just how it really is just like its own thing. There's nothing else like it in the whole world.
Yeah, when they first discovered the platypus, remember that they didn't believe it. They thought it was a fake. You know, This is around the time of Darwin starting to take hold a little bit, and you know, you're getting these secular scientists. They're like, this isn't this is fake. This is a fraud, this animal, because it had all these different characteristics and just, you know, totally would not fit into any kind of evolutionary paradigm. So What's up with this particular new find that they've got with the platypus?
Okay, so we got another one. So in a recent study, they were looking at the melanosomes in platypus hair, which are the tiny structures and cells that make pigments. So in mammals, they're normally solid, be kind of for like hair color and stuff like that. But in birds, they're normally more hollow and rod shaped, which kind of helps produce like the bright colors that we see with birds. So the platypus just not fitting into any bucket as it always does. Those melanosomes in it turned out to be hollow, more kind of like bird ones, as opposed to the, and the article says 120 other mammals that were examined. So they're not also just like bird melanosomes either, because the bird ones are hollow, but they're not spherical like the ones in the platypus. So it still doesn't even fit nicely in that bucket. So it's funny because the lead author also said that it was totally unexpected, that they, you know, just kind of mind blowing. This added to the list of things the platypus that are mind blowing.
Yeah. And while you were talking about it, I just typed into ChatGPT, give me quick list of the weird platypus features. So it's got a duck-like bill, beaver-like tail, webbed feet, lays eggs, even though it's a mammal, produces milk, but has no nipples. Males have venomous spurs. It detects electricity with its bill. It has dense waterproof fur. Its fur glows under ultraviolet light. And then you just mentioned the hollow melanosomes. And it has 10 sex chromosomes, not two. It uses gravel plates instead of adult teeth to grind food. It stores prey in cheek pouches while diving. Well, that's interesting. It walks awkwardly on land because its legs stick out sideways. And it's one of the few surviving monotremes, egg-laying mammals.
Yes. Just such a funny creature. And the thing that's so great about it is it's not a problem at all for God. It just shows God's immense creativity just completely on display. But it's such a problem for evolution because it can't fit nicely into the buckets that they need it to fit into. It has to fit into something with other creatures, or else how did it, or else that means it had to evolve independently by itself, which they know they don't have anything to show that. So they have to try to get it to fit with something else, and it just doesn't.
Yeah, and I always wondered, you know, we'll get to ask Jesus someday who created the platypus. I mean, what were you thinking? Were you, you created sense of humor. Were you thinking, hey, there's going to be men that'll probably be goofy and think of stupid ideas like evolution. I'm going to really throw something in there that is kind of funny. It has all these different traits that you can't explain. I don't know. It'll be interesting to hear his take
on it. That will be interesting to hear.
Got around to the blueprint of the platypus. What was going through your mind at the time?
Yeah, could he just be like, oh, he's kind of felt like having a little bit of fun.
Yeah, definitely. So, okay, Ryan. What's up next? How about, let's see here. How about the brown cow? Now, wait a minute. The brown cow uses tools. How? What the heck's going on there? How can a cow use a tool? Does it got a jackhammer? Is it, what's going on here?
Well, the brown cow is basically using a back scratcher. It's essentially what it's doing. But
I like
it's funny because, yeah, it's funny because, you know, evolutionists always want to talk about how humans and monkeys are really close and monkeys use tools. But they actually found the scientists who were doing the original study were more impressed with what this cow was doing, because it was doing like multi-phase tool use, where it would use a different tool to like get that tool and then grab it and then itch its back and then use the other side for different reasons. So it's just funny. The picture they have in there is pretty good too. So I just can see this cow like reaching back and itching itself with this thing. It's just interesting. And it also shows that the primates aren't the only animals that can use tools, because they always like to show videos of some monkey doing something like using a rock to open up a nut, which is, you know, highly intelligent, obviously. But they're not the only ones who do it. And the cows do too. I know it wasn't the point of the article, but it always does just make me laugh when people try to talk about how smart an animal is for doing a simpleton task, like opening up a rock with a tool. Like if dolphins are so smart, why don't they invent a phone? You know, but I digress. But
it reminds me of a couple of stories of like when they tried to do the experiment of monkeys typing Shakespeare, and I don't remember exactly what happened, but I remember things like all the monkey did was type the letter S and defecate on the keyboard. So, and then another super funny one fact I remember is on Creation Magazine. It was on their very back cover. It was an artist rendering And you look at it, and it's just splotches on a board. And you had these some of these people that go look at it, and they don't know what it's from. And like, oh, look at the detail here. And look at, oh, this must be, look over here. There's this pattern. Oh, this is interesting. You know how you've got so much dumb art out there that people like? Well, this was actually just a monkey randomly splashing paint on a canvas, and you had some liberals looking at this thing. Oh, look at the art on this thing. It was totally random splatches. No design or no anything at all, other than maybe weird thoughts in the monkey's head. But even that probably wasn't. He just found it. He just found paint and started doing that. Yeah, we should do that. We should get a monkey to paint some art, right? And then we'll take it to downtown Denver and sell it to all the liberals down there, make some good money.
That would actually be a pretty funny Real Science Radio bit.
Do you remember that artist? I can't remember his name. We were on a cruise years ago, and
he was
popular, and his art was so goofy looking. I remember you drew us on a piece of paper on the plane home. You're like, hey, look, I can do his same art, and it looked just like his stuff.
Well, I drew it on my phone.
I remember the guy's name.
I drew it on my phone.
Yeah.
It looked just like it. Oh, what was that guy's name? I can't remember. Yeah. I know his art was selling for like $10,000.
Yeah, like, crazy. So, all right, Ryan, we've probably got time for one more, I'm thinking.
Okay.
Let's see. How about, there's so much in this magazine. I'm thinking maybe the Chinese skull that's out of sync with evolution.
Yeah, so it's cool because this one shows that human intelligence isn't just a new thing. It's throughout history. And the article talks about how the Yunxian II Homo erectus cranium from China had already been assigned three different ages by various methods. So they were trying to date this skull, and one of them had it going from like 488 million years. There was another one in the middle. And then the last one was 1.1 million years. So obviously they're way off on the age of this thing, but that's not the point. The point is one of the co-authors was looking at it, and this cranium was about the same size as heads now, which the cranium, you know, the holding the brain. And what's bad about that for evolution is you've got this thing that they're dating up to 2.6 million years old, and the brain size is the same as the modern brain size, because their kind of pre-existing thinking was, oh, they have these human skulls that are smaller. So they're like, oh, the brains were smaller back then, and they evolved to be big like they are now. But this one's pretty big already, so they've got a problem because, oh, well, maybe humans back then had the equally sized brains or were smart as we are now, and maybe there's just varying skull sizes depending on the person, like we see in modern days. So it's pretty bad for them because, yeah, this thing looks like a modern skull and is the same size as a modern skull, but it shouldn't be, because the person back then shouldn't have had this size of a brain.
Yeah. And I always, on Real Science Radio, we've always talked about how we thought it was silly argument anyways, that brains, you know, the bigger the brain, the smarter you are. And, you know, I look at some of the Chinese women, they don't have really big, they probably have smaller brains than a lot of people. And they're, at least ones I've met in engineering, they're pretty smart. So, you know, brain size doesn't mean you're going to be smarter. And so this is just another, dates for this fossil don't fit into their paradigm. This happens all the time. We've got some really good shows with Dr. Carl Werner on this whole ape-man fraud. So much of this stuff turned out to be fraud that they were trying to push on us that people don't even know about. And we're not talking like mistakes, because we're careful not to, you know, accuse somebody of lying, outright lying or anything. A lot of times, like in this case, they're coming up with dates. They have such a bad paradigm, this stuff doesn't fit, it doesn't work. But there were many cases where it was outright fraud. They were intentionally lying to try to sell this whole ape human ancestry thing. And, you know, you shouldn't have to do that if you actually have real evidence, but they never have had that evidence. And we will link to those shows with Dr. Carl Werner. Those were some of our really good shows. It was a couple years ago. In fact, we need to have Dr. Werner back on. But Ryan, this is just another example where they have another problem with evolution and human chimp ancestry, all that stuff. It's totally out of sync, as the article says, with evolution. So, okay, Ryan. Well, you know, there's so much more in this magazine, but we're out of time.
Yeah, this is a lot of good stuff. Yeah, so people should go read it yourselves. There's a really cool one about reading and how basically humans were ingrained with that. Our DNA were genes coded to read from day one, even before reading started, which is really cool. And the B one, yeah. So go and read it for yourself. There's a lot of cool stuff in this one.
Yeah, and Dr. Bergman, his article was great, and he had a little side box on the insect evolution, so-called. And, you know, I remember he discussed what's something called the hexapod gap. And so the earliest known insect fossil is said to be about 385-million-year-old wingless creature that looks like a silverfish. But then for the next alleged 60 billion years, there isn't so much as a dragonfly, grasshopper, or roach. It's a huge gap. It's one of just many problems. So insect evolution is another thing that just doesn't exist. There's no evidence for it. The evidence is against it. It's the evidence supports sudden appearance of insects in the fossil record, just like we would expect. You know, insects were created on day six. They were created in a single day, not over millions and millions of years. And then, you know, somehow there's a huge gap between when they evolved to this and then this. And there's no evidence of any evolution at all, period, in the fossil record. So anyways, Ryan, it's always great to go over Creation Magazine. Like you said, there's so many more things we could have talked about. And that's what's great about it, just the amount of content that you get in just one copy of the magazine. They've got a section for kids in there. It's just really great stuff. So
yeah, looking forward to the next one.
Yep. All righty. So for Ryan Williams, I'm Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.